You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Libya gets another government, but is it likely to get to do any more governing than the two the country already has? My guests Jane Kinnamont and Matthew Green will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including the Associated Press becoming the story as unsavoury details of its World War II years are revealed. What compromises should news agencies make to report from inside tyrannies? Amnesty International's report into working conditions at Qatar's World Cup sites. Will one more condemnation make any difference? And the difference between a formal meeting, an informal meeting, and a formal informal meeting. We'll attempt to calibrate the level of snub delivered to Turkey's president by America's. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and Matthew Green, formerly the FT's correspondent in West Africa and Pakistan / Afghanistan, among others, and author most recently of Aftershock, The Untold Story of Surviving Peace. Welcome both. We will start tonight with Libya, a country which has now been without a coherent government for nearly 5 years, though this has not been for the want of people offering to serve as one. Yesterday, Libya's two rival governments, one based in Tripoli, the other in Benghazi, were joined by a third, the UN-backed Government of National Accord, it says here, led by nominal Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj. Jane, first of all, who is Mr. Sarraj, the putative new Prime Minister of Libya?
Well, we all remember the Arab Spring when crowds across the Middle East called for the UN to foist unknown technocrats upon their country.
Is he an unknown technocrat?
That's essentially what has happened here in Libya. He did work for the former Gaddafi regime as a technocrat in the housing ministry. So that in itself is a somewhat contentious issue because Libyans have been divided over whether anybody who took part in the previous government should be in office. But so many people worked for the public sector that if you don't include them, you are excluding probably most.
Well, it was similar, I guess, to Iraq, in which America made that ludicrous decision to sack everybody who'd been a member of the Ba'ath Party, thereby unemploying the country's entire trained, professional, educated middle class.
That's exactly right. So the Transitional National Council, which initially represented the Libyan opposition, said that they wouldn't do that. But in fact, on the ground, many people called for them to do it. And that was one of the many issues that have been dividing the two governments that were contesting for power before the UN agreed to a government of national accord, which is one of the only things that the other two governments can agree on, that they do not support this government. So Sarraj is meant to be the head of a presidential council. This is an idea that has also been tried in some UN talks over Yemen, the idea being that to get legitimacy, you actually now need more than one man. And he himself isn't a particularly well-known or charismatic person, partly because the idea is to spread power somewhat more.
Matthew, I'm reminded, speaking of Iraq, of that bewildering period shortly before the invasion in 2003, where various Iraqi exiles were rounded up by America and photographed in conference rooms in Geneva and people saying, this is the next government of Iraq. And as you can probably remember at the time, to a chorus of the actual Iraqi people of, who the hell are they? is it possible to impose a government like this on a country, especially one in the shambles that Libya is, and especially without, it strikes me as the thing missing here, any armed backup at all? This government, such as it is, had to be sailed in by the Libyan Navy because it wasn't allowed to use the airport, and is currently in the Busita naval base in Tripoli, without very much in the way of guns between them.
It does sound like a rather wonderful example of wishful thinking, doesn't it, by the international community and the UN. I mean, you're right, the question is, isn't it, about troops? We can think about Somalia, where a rather similar approach has been tried, but that was only after African Union peacekeepers were fighting al-Shabaab militants and driving them out of Mogadishu over years of very, very intense fighting. So the idea that you can sort of, not even fly someone in, but sail somebody in like this, and hope that the two factions who are at each other's throats will sort of magically decide to totally do a volte face and start supporting him does seem rather far-fetched, doesn't it?
Well, on that front, I mean, this move does at least appear to have succeeded where so many other things have failed in uniting those two factions, who can at least get together on the idea that they're not really interested in the input of this third faction. The whole story of Libya, Jane, has been, I mean, it's been an example, an exemplar indeed, of the truth that you should always bet on cock-up rather than conspiracy, because it's been one after another. I'm just wondering, is it possible, and I suspect this is one of those self-answering questions, but is it possible that this enterprise has been set up to fail, thereby necessitating a measure of foreign intervention?
I think the intervention in Libya by Western powers in 2011 was not something that really had a conspiracy or even a strategy behind it. It was something that came up as an opportunity in this febrile environment of the Arab Spring. Western governments were on the back foot. They felt they hadn't seen Tunisia coming. They hadn't seen Egypt coming. They wanted to get ahead of the curve of history as they saw it in Libya. Meanwhile, the Libyan opposition were adamant they wanted any intervention to be very limited. They didn't want troops to come onto the ground. They thought Libyans would reject those. So you had an odd situation where there was an intervention and then there was no follow-up. And it's really the issue of ISIS and the issue of migration that has pulled the interests of the international community back towards Libya. Before that, it was really being seen as peripheral, and there was very little appetite to do anything about it.
Now, Matthew, you raised also the comparison of Somalia there, a country which Libya is resembling increasingly in all sorts of ways, divided, anarchic.
And people yet, driving around in 4x4s with large machine guns mounted on the back.
All of that, Islamist terrorism being based out of there and yet situated in an inconveniently important part of the world, geographically and strategically. How much will the Somalia experience be informing approaches to Libya?
Well, I think there's one big difference with Libya, of course, is the oil, which is a pretty significant factor. I mean, there's a lot of oil probably off the coast of Somalia, but no one's figured out a way to start drilling it yet. I mean, Libya is still exporting fairly significant amount, not as much as it was before it kind of descended into conflict with the fall of the Gaddafi regime, but it's still very much an oil exporting country. And it was interesting to read about how the central bank is actually still distributing payments to militias on both sides of the conflict. It seems to be about the one institution that's still going. It's rather wonderful to think of central bank officials sort of getting their suits on each morning and turning up to work, being the one island of sort of functioning administration in this kind of growing sea of anarchy.
Final thought on this subject, Jane. What happens if/when this doesn't work?
Well, there's high potential for further fighting, and it's going to be very fragmented because this isn't an issue of two governments or three governments plus Islamic State. This is an issue of there still being maybe 300 different militias in Libya who are loosely assembled into coalitions around the different claimants to have the government, but who have very different, very localised concerns. So there's likely to be a really localised and really fragmented conflict, which will allow Islamic State to continue to thrive, at least in some areas. There are scenarios for regional powers being drawn in, the most likely candidates being the Egyptians, who are really worried about spillover into Egypt and who have one of the most significant armies in the Middle East, probably the most significant in the Arab world.
Okay, well, let's move on now to a much-pondered quirk of journalistic history, that the Associated Press news agency was able to keep operating in Nazi Germany up until Germany's declaration of war on the US in December 1941. This was far past the point at which other foreign news organisations had been forced to close in Germany for either obdurately employing Jews or just giving up attempting independent journalism under the dictatorship. German historian Harriet Schoenberg has now confirmed what might have been suspected, that the AP had actually entered into a formal agreement with the regime. Matthew, first of all, the terms of this agreement are pretty grim. This includes supplying Nazi material to US newspapers, opening its photo library to SS propaganda units. How embarrassed should the AP of today be by this, 70 years later?
Well, this is rather remarkable, isn't it? I mean, I worked for Reuters for years, and obviously AP was one of our main rivals. But even I felt a kind of sense of I felt hurt on AP's behalf to see a headline: AP denies collaborating with the Nazis. I mean, it is a kind of remarkable sort of just the idea that the AP would find its name sort of caught up in something like this is pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, they are denying it. They're saying that an accurate characterization is that the AP and other organizations were subject to intense pressure from the Nazi regime. AP rate management resisted the pressure while working to gather accurate, vital, objective news, blah, 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 blah.
But I mean, you ask about whether it has contemporary significance, and it's interesting because the denial is very much couched in the sort of terms that you might expect if this was a contemporary allegation. But there has been questions raised about AP, particularly the North Korea Bureau, which opened up a few years ago, the first foreign news agency to be allowed to operate from Pyongyang for a very long time. And there's questions about how objective the coverage has been from there. And AP's not alone. There's been many other similar questions raised, Bloomberg's coverage of China being another prominent example. So it's certainly a very live contemporary issue.
Well, on that subject, Jane, of it being a live contemporary issue, doesn't every news organization, especially a big multinational one, doesn't everybody make some accommodation with the government where they're operating, or the culture with where they're operating, or the politics of where they're operating?
They all need access, and governments are often good at bartering access for some kind of measure of control. Many countries also have legal restrictions on photographic licenses and so forth. It's often more tightly controlled than, you know, simple words. So it is an issue for everyone, but who wants to base a photojournalist in an authoritarian country or get cameras in?
Yeah, and it's also very... It's not explicitly stated, but it operates in terms of self-censorship, doesn't it? You know that there's certain lines in certain countries that you can't cross, otherwise you're liable to be kicked out. So these lines are operating everywhere. It's just that we don't normally talk about them or see them.
But just to follow that up, Matthew, because you've worked abroad for Reuters as a proper news journalist. When I've worked abroad as a feature writer, and there's been a measure of official interference, and I'm thinking of places like Libya, like Iran, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Tunisia, where I've been followed around, pestered, assigned minders, etc., etc. But I'm in the position where I can make that part of the story and have fun with it, which you can't really if you're a news reporter. Working for Reuters, did you ever reach a point at which you just thought, I can't do this, I can't work like this, I'm either not doing this story or I'm not working in this place?
I don't know if I ever hit that line myself, but certainly there's a lot of colleagues who found themselves in that situation and been barred from countries. I mean, someone like Eritrea, for example, is the classic, the sort of North Korea of Africa, where basically no one can get in or out to report. So it is a real dilemma. And yeah, there's definitely time. I think it's interesting whether as journalists we are diligent enough about interrogating ourselves as to the kinds of subjects that we just think, actually, better not go there, even though we probably should.
I was just talking to someone today who's trying to set up a new journalistic project based in the Middle East, and this person was from the Gulf and worrying about where could I set up anywhere in the Middle East where I wouldn't be forced to at least self-censor. And they had just settled on Lebanon and Beirut as the only oasis of non-censorship in the region when their home country barred all of its nationals from travelling to Lebanon. So we concluded that the only option for someone wanting to do this in the Middle East was to build some kind of artificial island with its own press laws, or maybe some kind of boat that would float around like a radio-free Europe.
An airship.
Evading censorship.
That's far from the worst idea. I mean, a kind of Middle Eastern news equivalent of those British pirate radio stations of the 60s and 70s operating just beyond national waters. Final thought on this one, Matthew. And again, I often wonder with things like this whether governments, especially tyrannies, which tend towards the lumbering and slow-moving, actually understand modern media. Because have we reached the point at which making any overt attempt to censor something just makes people more likely to talk about it?
Well, that's right. Or kicking out a journalist is a great way to guarantee headlines, isn't it? But I also think there's a commercial aspect sometimes in these situations. I mean, I just mentioned Bloomberg in China. There was a huge scandal a few years ago about the idea that Bloomberg had essentially tempered its investigations of corrupt Chinese officials, essentially because they wanted to make sure they kept selling terminals into the financial or into financial customers operating in China. So that tension as well can come to the fore as fore too.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Jane Kinnamont and Matthew Green. Coming up next, the however many times you say it, it never seems more plausible, Qatar's World Cup.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Hong Kong, our bureau chief is James Chambers.
There's no such thing as an ordinary day in Hong Kong. On any one day, I may be interviewing a city mayor or having coffee with a hotelier or chatting with an interior designer and then trying out the latest bar or restaurant. And mixed in with all of this, there'll be some wacky or outrageous news coming out of China which deserves to be covered on the radio. So it's this variety that I really love about the job.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House and Matthew Green, the journalist and author of Aftershock. And we turn now to Qatar, which is still, for some reason, the designated host of the next World Cup but one, despite the fact that it would make scarcely less sense for Doha to stage a Winter Olympics. To the surprise of absolutely nobody, a new report by Amnesty International has suggested that the conditions endured by the foreign labourers building the World Cup venues are dreadful. The money poor, the accommodation worse, and coercion, including the confiscation of passports, rampant. Jane, Amnesty International said every migrant labourer they spoke to reported some sort of abuse. The depressing thing about this report is that it's not really news, is it? Everybody knew this. Will one more condemnation of the conditions of workers in Qatar make any difference?
You're starting here from an extremely low base in terms of a systematic exploitation of insecure migrant labour across the Gulf countries. I think the scrutiny that has come as a result of the World Cup has actually been very important. It has sent a strong message to Gulf governments that this really does damage their reputations and brands, something that they do care about. You've seen similar pressure on UAE begin to start to make a difference. And in Qatar too, the workers who work on the World Cup tend to be treated less badly than the workers who work on other construction projects. I'm not saying that's a great situation, but it's something that has had an impact, but not nearly enough, and it needs to continue to be scrutinised.
It is, I guess, one of those things where a country hosting a World Cup or an Olympics or a Grand Prix has discovered that the global attention it attracts is something of a double-edged thing. People will spot this stuff if it's there to be spotted. Matthew, Qatar says predictably that it is, and I quote, concerned, and that it will, and I quote, investigate. Any reason in particular to believe either of those statements?
Well, it's encouraging to hear that there's been some improvement. I mean, reading some of the details of the report, it does sound pretty egregious, the idea that migrant workers they have to pay essentially to apply for these jobs before they even come over. Then they're not getting paid on time, essentially treated like prisoners, essentially like slave labour. So it is pretty egregious. But I suppose the question I'm interested in is whether the sponsors, the big multinational companies that bankroll the World Cup are also raising a kind of clamour about this, because they're the ones ultimately who pay for these sporting events, and they should be the ones who are pushing the government as well as human rights organisations, I would have thought.
Well, Amnesty International has suggested in its report that such sponsors, which include Coca-Cola, Adidas, McDonald's, the usual suspects, that they lean on Qatar. I mean, Jane, is that imaginable, that this could reach a point, that this publicity could escalate to a point at which sponsors like that start trying to think that you know, is it really worth it? Do we look good standing next to this World Cup or not? Or I mean, I guess even if you want to take a really wacky counterintuitive idea, what if a sponsor decided maybe we'd look better if we made a public show of dumping it?
You saw that with the Formula One in Bahrain after the uprising and crackdown in 2011.
So.
It was cancelled because of pressure from sponsors who felt it was going to be embarrassing. And you've seen it to some extent with companies that operate in UAE or the big art and academic projects that have taken place where it's been those international organisations that have pushed for better conditions for workers on their projects, but ones that haven't really had a trickle down to other workers.
You were in Qatar recently, I believe, Jane. I mean, 6 years out from the World Cup, is it obvious that it is underway? Is the scale of it apparent?
Absolutely. I mean, I first visited Qatar in 2004. The population has more than doubled in that time, which is an insane level of population growth.
And it but partly are those mainly migrant workers?
They are almost entirely migrant workers. Working on this huge construction boom, and the World Cup has been a massive part of that in recent years. But the World Cup bid was won when the price of gas that Qatar sells was a lot higher. So one of the big worries for the workers is that non-payment risks could increase. Already Qatar is cutting back its spending across the board by 20 to 30% on the construction projects outside the World Cup. And this is a kind of funny austerity Qatar style where the negative impact is entirely felt by foreigners who are basically lack any kind of job security, while nationals so far have been almost completely insulated from it.
I mean, Matthew, is there, I just wonder, something endemic in the culture of the governance of football in particular, that between the FIFA scandals, between, you could even argue, the award of the 2018 World Cup to Russia, the sport does just seem completely unembarrassable. And I do wonder if that's because they know that the fans won't desert. There is no chance at all that wherever you hold the World Cup, if you held the World Cup in North Korea at the risk of tempting fate, people would still go.
To be covered by the AP Bureau.
Indeed. Yeah. People would still go and people would watch it on television.
Well, that's true. And isn't that, I suppose, a reflection of what happens on a national level, where football, even a few decades ago, used to be a much more kind of, it wasn't the glamorous, highly paid activity that it is today. We didn't see these scandals involving footballers with, you know, details of their private lives, their wives, this kind of opulent lifestyle that has become sort of part and parcel of the sport. That just wasn't the case going back several decades. And there does seem, I mean, whether you can say the sport's become corrupted or not, I don't know, maybe that's going a bit too far, but the whole kind of spirit of it does feel very different from the sort of entertainment it was going back a few decades.
Well, finally tonight, as any number of journalists, bloggers, protesters and online pranksters have learned the hard way, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan tends toward the sensitive. One shudders, therefore, to imagine the scale of his umbrage upon learning that, while visiting Washington this week for the 2016 Nuclear Security Summit, he will not be afforded a formal meeting with President Barack Obama. Instead, there will be what is being termed an informal conversation. Specifically, White House spokesman, and let us just now take a moment once more to applaud the fact that his name actually is Josh Earnest. He said Barack Obama would make at least a little time for some kind of conversation. Is this a snub?
Will there be a photo op, I think, is one of the big questions. If you have a photo with a handshake or something like this, this is going to be able to be reported in Turkey as a proper meeting. But if there's no such thing, if it's just I can't literally ignore you, so I am going to say something to you as we meet over dinner, then yes, it is a snub.
What would be the political foundation of such a snub? Because obviously Turkey is an extremely important country for all sorts of reasons, and he is currently an extremely important player for all sorts of reasons, and doesn't he know it? What would be the benefit from America's point of view of winding him up, as they seem to be doing here?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I wonder whether it's more the fact that America's so unimpressed with Turkey's performance over Iraq and the response to ISIS. Mm. There's a lot of ambiguity, isn't there, about the Turkish position?
Absolutely.
They've been obviously opposed to American backing for the Kurds, who are one of the very few effective forces who are actually taking ISIS on. And there's been this long-running saga about questions about Turkish businessmen being involved in the smuggling of oil or buying of oil from ISIS. So that ambiguity, I think, has been there for a long time. And perhaps the Americans are wanting to send a fairly strong message, albeit in a very delicate way.
Jane, how seriously are such things taken at senior government level? Our producer found us a glossary published by the UN Institute for Training and Research, which, you know, a glossary of helpful diplomatic terms, which includes, and I'm quoting here, formal informals. And these are, it says here, the most formal of the informal meetings in the committees of the General Assembly or some other intergovernmental forums. Formal informals are off-the-record meetings with no sound recordings or press releases. So is this a formal informal Erdogan is being offered here?
It sounds like an informal informal, but these things are pretty incomprehensible to most people. It reminds me of recently going to a conference about Saudi Arabia and hearing a diplomat who's an ambassador to Saudi Arabia speaking about Saudi Arabia. And I heard him speak and I thought, wow, he's being utterly damning. And then I thought, if I had heard this maybe 10 years ago before I worked in this kind of diplomacy and policy area, I would have thought, wow, he's really sucking up to them. But you get used to this kind of code that most people can't begin to comprehend.
I mean, a formal informal or even an informal informal, that's clearly not going to be as bad as the dreaded full and frank exchange of views, is it? Because that's apparently the absolute
that's
worst.
That's really nasty.
Yeah, that is...
We should never have those.
Afterwards, yeah, exactly.
If there was any doubt about Monocle's commitment to highbrow journalism, the fact that I can be on a program where a glossary of terms for UN delegates forms part of the reading list before appearing is to be utterly applauded and saluted.
There was a weird development this week, though, and I'd be interested in what you both think of this, between the US and Turkey, which I don't know, I can't believe more of a thing wasn't made of it, that the US ordered the evacuation of military families from the Incirlik Air Base. This is one of the biggest air bases in the world, believed to be armed with nuclear weapons, and the US doesn't think it's safe enough to keep military families on. Was that actually a security issue? Or, I mean, I'll ask you first, Jane, or is that a signal to Turkey that we don't entirely trust you?
I do not know in this case, but that kind of signal has been used in the past to send messages to other countries, remembering that those families also usually create a lot of economic activity as well. Then removing them can be a subtle way of putting pressure on
presumably country. These families were still there when Russia and Turkey were loggerheads a few
just
weeks
thinking
ago,
it would be
which seemed like had a much more risk of missiles
absolutely.
Starting to fly around than now.
Desperately difficult, though, to imagine what could possibly be a threat to the Incirlik Air Base.
Well, one hopes so, unless there's something we don't know.
I mean, if we're living in a world in which there is a meaningful
threat
to the Incirlik
Donald Trump
Air Base.
Hasn't ruled out using nuclear weapons against ISIS, so, frankly, all bets are off, aren't they?
Donald Trump,
very
mercifully...
reassuring to read that.
Mercifully does not get to make that decision yet. I mean, Jane, just on this, though, is it a big deal for someone like Erdogan to be able to go back to his home country with a picture of him with the President of the United States? Does that still carry cachet, especially when Erdogan has made a point of setting himself at odds with the President of the United States?
Well, Turkey is deeply divided over Erdogan. He does just have a majority of supporters, but he has many, many detractors. And seeing him apparently isolated or rebuked by an ally will be something that they will flag and that they will use against him. But he will be betting on the fact that Europe can't do without him.
We will have to leave it there. Jane Kinnamont and Matthew Green, thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Charlie Young. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next, then at 1900, The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. And you can hear more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.